ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford.
Listen!
It's Music Now and Then, and my guest on today's programme is the composer Lisa Lim, who I've been speaking to on this show since the mid-90s. This is her opera, The Oresteia.
Listen!
Furies in Lisa Lim's opera, The Oresteia. We heard a whole bunch of different singers with Elysian Ensemble, directed by Sandro Gorli. And you're going to hear a conversation that I recorded with the composer just before the opening night of Sydney Chamber Opera's production with Elysian of The Oresteia just this week. Lisa Lim wrote the Oresteia with the director Barry Kosky, and together they cobbled together a libretto from Aeschylus, the origin, and also bits of Sappho, and also words by the poet Tony Harrison, who had made his own adaptation of the Oresteia for London's National Theatre. This was in 1993, and the recording that we just heard was made by the original performers. I was there on the opening night, but I wasn't yet presenting the music show. Christopher Lawrence was, and he introduced it like this.
A major new Australian theatre work received its premiere last week, well, to judge by the first beta reviews anyway. It's a realisation of the ancient Greek drama The Oresteia, with music and text by young composer Lisa Lim, and text and stage direction by the equally young director Barry Kosky. It's by all accounts a production with no soft options for the audience. It's confronting, cathartic, and challenging.
Christopher Lawrence spoke to Barry Kosky about the work.
It explores notions of chaos and democracy. It explores notions of revenge. It explores notions of the family. And these elements are, I think, woven into quite an interesting fabric, or musical fabric, by Lisa that is incredibly dense. And it does demand a great deal of concentration. It's not an easy work. In fact, it's probably one of the most difficult things I've done. But I think the rewards are enormous for audiences.
It's not an easy work. Confronting, challenging, difficult, these are the sorts of words that have regularly been applied to Lisa Lim's music. And it was one of the reasons she looked beyond Australia for performance opportunities. She talked about this on the music show in 2004.
Most of my performances take place in Europe, and partially that's to do with the... you know, there's a kind of much larger infrastructure for new music and concerts, you know, in general in Europe than in Australia. There's certainly a much stronger kind of scene for new music, all kinds of new music. And I guess each city or each centre has its own particular history of that and its own context. That was one of the interesting things on this recent trip. Going from LA to New York and then Paris, Milan, Vienna, Berlin, and actually finding the cultural differences quite starkly different, both in terms of what was being presented in each place and kind of the different histories of performance, histories of listening in each place. So, for instance, in LA, there's much more of a sense of people having to construct that history. And during the when my piece was played, they had this big building music festival where they also looked at, that was sort of symposia and conferences and lectures, also looked at earlier music, so looking at Berlioz, looking at Monteverdi, looking at Xenakis, for instance, and Feldman, as well as kind of very newly written pieces. So there's this sense of having to construct history, a historical context, in the way that you would perhaps never have to do in a place like Europe.
Put in the way that we do here.
That's right, yes. So in fact, I found a lot of similarities between what was happening in LA and in Australia.
Lisa Lim ended up as professor in the music department at Huddersfield University in England, and so she was well placed for more European performances. She once told me she'd never write for the piano because it lacked the ability to produce gliding tones. But then she wrote a big solo piano work, Four Seasons, inspired by the art of Cy Twombly. And more recently, there's been a piano concerto. Composers change. Well, the good ones do. But Lisa Lim's attitude to the orchestra has, I think, remained fairly constant.
The orchestra is an instrument. It has its own performance practice, its traditions, you know, and an incredible sort of performance legacy. And I'm working with all those things, perhaps in the same way that I have also worked with single instruments and explored their extended technique. So harmony is part and parcel of that.
Thank you.
Australia is a cultural space in which hybridity can be a really fertile thing creatively. I think it's a space in which one can potentially break down monolithic cultural assumptions. I don't think this is really happening that much in music, actually. People still have a rhetoric about Europe and Asia that treats these things as rather kind of self-contained blocks. But I think it is happening in visual arts culture, particularly in Brisbane, for instance. There is this sensitivity, for instance, to nuances of different Chinese cultures, different Indian cultures, and that's really kind of opening up a way of thinking about cultural difference in a much richer and more complex way. And I think that is a really fertile area and a way of moving beyond what has already been attempted or explored in Australian music in relation to Asia or in relation to kind of multicultural thinking.
That's some of the second movement of the Compass, Lisa Lim's orchestral piece. And you heard Karin Levine playing flute and William Barton's Didgeridoo, the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra conducted by Christoph Poppen. Lisa Lim's work has often dealt with ritual and repetition. And as we come to this new production of an opera that's now more than 30 years old, it's interesting to consider. I asked Lisa about this idea of ritual and whether we as an audience need to understand the ritual or not.
One definition of art for me is that it demonstrates the limits of centralized conscious knowledge. You know, by which I mean that whether you're talking about a piece by Harrison Birtwistle or a Mozart symphony or William Forsythe's, you know, Eidos Telos, one can't rationally know everything about it, you know, and I don't think that those pieces of art can be totally exhausted, you know, in one's interpretation. You know, one can't sort of know every position or see it from every single position and exhaust the work. And that's something which I'm really interested in terms of, I suppose, exploring this idea of the freedom of art.
That was Lisa Lim on The Music Show in 2008. So we've heard some of my conversations with Lisa over the years, and we're about to have a new one. We're going to transport you to the stage of the opening night of a new production of the Oresteia in a moment. But first, let's hear a little more from the opera itself. This is the original 1993 recording. And this is how it starts.
Oh,
Lisa Lim, welcome to the music show. I think you should be welcoming me to your theatre, actually.
Thank you. Welcome everyone to the party.
This is this series of interviews of which you are a part is called Music Now and Then, and in it I've been talking to people who have been guests on this show since I've been doing it, which is a long time, more than 30 years, and you are one of those people. And it's an opportunity to try and take stock of the sorts of things that have happened in the last three decades, and a lot has happened to you and a lot has happened to your music. And this is a perfect opportunity to do this, because here is a piece which is 33 years old. And my first question really is a now and then question. How do you feel about this now, about listening to this music, which is almost from your childhood?
Thanks for the question, Andy. No, it's incredible to revisit a work that was performed 33 years ago in Melbourne in Theatre Works in St Kilda. We were recklessly optimistic. We believed in doing really unrealistic things, and I still feel this exhilaration, this absolute kind of joy of seeing Sydney Chamber Opera and Elysian once again do a recklessly optimistic, unrealistic production so extraordinarily well.
In a way, I suppose you could say that all opera is reckless and optimistic. But we'll come back to that. Well, I would like to ask about your sound world, because we're going to get an early example of it in this piece. It's an ensemble which consists of the kinds of instruments you would find in an orchestra, but there's always something in your ensembles which doesn't sort of belong in that context. And in this case, you know, the percussionist plays a steel pan, and there's a saz, a Turkish saz, although it's actually synthesized on this occasion. But there are sounds in your ensembles which make each one almost unique. The hardanga fiddle or sitar or contrabass recorder, and it becomes a kind of focal point, I think. Is that how you think of it?
Yeah, I've always been really inspired by confronting unusual or, you know, non-standard or non-orchestral instruments. In this case, there's also an electric guitar, which was an instrument that Daryl Buckley played. And so that's kind of the reason for it. It was friends, it was, well, my partner that played these instruments. And so the choices, the instrumental choices, were about relationship. Yeah.
But they alter the sonority as well, don't they? And your music is about sonority almost above all.
Yeah. I think the presence of something which is out of the ordinary, that provides a kind of strangeness, it creates a sort of gravitational curve, I think, which I think I really respond to. It's hard for me to write a piece just for, you know, a kind of normal instrumentation. I like to have that little bit of grit to respond to, you know, to that really prompts this sense of, yeah, I mean, for me, music is about travelling into other worlds, and I think the instruments really help me do that.
And the strange instrument, or the odd one out, if I can put it that way, you know what I mean, seems to kind of suck the other instruments towards it, and colours the whole ensemble, I find.
Oh, I love that image, yeah, the sense of, I guess the gravitational pull of certain sounds and certain instruments. And certainly in this opera, you know, we get a sense that each personality, each of the singers and also the musicians that you'll see, have their own gravitational pull, that they are kind of really trying to open up a space to tell a story, that they're not just, I don't know, passive participants somehow, you know, they're really kind of forming or conduits for certain energies.
Let's come back to opera, the notion of opera, which is this, you've done five of them, and it's this kind of grand, expensive, extravagant art form. It always has been for 400 and something years. And I wonder whether you could talk about how you feel drawn to the genre, if we can call it that. It's such a wide thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the operas that I've written are chamber operas, so they have a certain kind of intimacy, you know, that they don't involve large orchestras. And as I said before, they often involve people that are friends, you know, that are part of my extended community. So I'm not writing opera in the abstract, but I'm really writing for a community of musicians and artists. But the thing about opera, and that of course is a word that creates, you know, friction or maybe a sort of mental hurdle for some people. I mean, you could say music theatre, you could say, an art form that's really driven by multiple, you know, kind of art forms coming together, the libretto, the music, the physicality of movement and sets and design. I mean, the thing I've always been really interested in this multi-art form world is one of ritual. So opera for me is about physicality. It is about the body. It is about the voice. It is the sense that we can access through this sort of ritual form, stories and memories and, you know, lineages of ideas that you can't necessarily access in ordinary everyday life. And so that high-keyed, super expressive, hyper-expressive world of opera is what I've always been drawn to. And that's certainly true of this one.
The theatricality, I suppose, is what interests me, because you could write a ritual piece for instruments alone. And I can think of composers like Harrison Birtwistle or Thea Musgrave, for instance, who've written works for orchestra where players get up, move and do things that you don't fully understand, but they're clearly dramatic and they're clearly ritualistic. But when you put it on stage, there's another layer involved. And maybe we could talk about this in the context of this show, The Oresteia, since it was your first opera, where the impulse came to retell Aeschylus' story, sort of, in your piece.
Yeah, I mean, that was so long ago. I was 24 when Barry Kosky rang up and said, oh, do you want to make an opera about The Oresteia? You know, and being young and naive, you go, yeah, why not? Let's give it a go. But of course, you know, the stories, the plays by Aeschylus with these extraordinary, you know, larger-than-life characters, Agamemnon, Clytemnestra, Cassandra, they're extraordinarily powerful and compelling. And I don't know how many people have seen The Odyssey, the Christopher Nolan film, yeah. And that's just fascinating, isn't it, that these stories keep coming back. There's an Oresteia for every generation. There's a Homer, there's the Odyssey for every generation. They're not done with. And I suppose that was really the key to making this work, was this idea that we wouldn't tell the entire plot, that would just take hours, but really focus in on some characters, some situations that we felt were not done with. You know, there's this idea of the characters as these unappeased voices that still demand to be heard. And that's definitely the case that I felt with characters, the women, Cassandra the prophetess, Clytemnestra the queen, and, you know, the Furies. I felt that these were stories that, in a way... they're ongoing, yeah. And, I mean, there's a great line. The libretto is kind of a reformatting of aspects of the great playwright Tony Harrison's play Agamemnon. And really at the crux of it is this line, time spatters the guilty, the living scratch open old scabs. So there is a sense that, you know, something's scabbed over, but it's, you know, we keep needing in a contemporary space to look at it again.
Picking at it,
yeah. There's an image.
What about drawing the music out of Clytemnestra and Cassandra and the Furies? How do you go about that? Where do you start?
The musical language of this work is... I think of it as about mouthfeel. It's words that are ingested and then vomited out and then, you know, swirled around in the mouth before they're transformed and come to you. So there are many, many sounds that are and you'll be astonished by the singers, what they do. There are many sounds that are sounds of that belong to the expressive world of grief, of lamentation, of pleasure, and so on. So it's a really sort of expanded palette of vocal sounds that is happening in this work.
And in your music in general, there is an attraction, correct me if I'm wrong, to the effort of making sound, which is almost the opposite of what classically trained musicians are meant to do. They're meant to sound effortless, and there's a lot of striving and a lot of energy that is audible in your music.
Yeah, I think that's perhaps a really polite way of saying there's a lot of distortion.
Oh, that too.
In this music.
Yeah.
But that's really kind of connected to the physicality of theatre, this sense that the singers are inhabited and possessed by these ghosts of the past. And in the process of being possessed, it means like pushing away, you know, ordinary sort of states of being. And so the distortion of sound attempting to be articulated is a way of, kind of experiencing this sense that the body is being taken over by something else. So that's, I've always been, yes, definitely attracted to the sonic expressivity of distortion. In that sense, the subject becomes the physicality that becomes part of the vocabulary of the music.
And it makes a noise.
It makes a noise, yeah.
What about the kinds of subjects that are appropriate vehicles for your music, apart from the one that we're going to see and hear tonight? Are you drawn, do you think, to particular sorts of stories?
I mean, ritual is a really strong through line in my work. I should actually say that in the opera, yes, there's a lot of this sort of noisy distortion and hyper-expressivity, but there's also great tenderness and lyricism that appears as well. And I think the presence of both, they both have their power. They both have a kind of power of violence about them. And that's certainly what happens in Aeschylus's plays. Yeah, the violence of a mother's grieving is also the mother's tenderness and lamentation. So there's this paradoxical, ambiguous line where the expressivity is not just one thing, it's many things. So in relation to this question about the stories I'm attracted to, I think that aspect of complexity and paradox and ambiguity is what always, kind of gets the radar going. Yeah.
But do you need the story, that you can justify to yourself putting music to? Do you, I can imagine stories that I couldn't dream of being sung on stage. And then there are others which seem to call out for that kind of treatment. And I wonder whether you feel the same and if you can pinpoint what that might be.
Yeah. Maybe I can be a bit more specific. One of the things I've really enjoyed in the last week of attending rehearsals is actually seeing the libretto again. Whilst the music has been very much in my ear because there's been a wonderful recording that's been out for the last 30 odd years, I haven't sort of seen the work performed live with the libretto, sort of projected. And so rather than story, I think it's certain kinds of words. It's the rhythm and the colour and the kind of propulsion of words that really, start the music off. And a lot of the libretto, as I said, comes from Tony Harrison, his very famous translation of the Aeschylus that he did for English National Opera in the mid-70s with Peter Hall directing and famously Harrison Birtwistle doing the music. I mean, Harrison Birtwistle was always, you know, he returned to Greek myth again and again. I have to say I'm really delighted in seeing these words and the, you know, in a funny way I felt, oh, my God, I could write that again, you know, when I looked at the words.
Yeah. Speaking of wanting to write it again or thinking you could, were you at all tempted to tinker with the music after all this time?
Well, I mean, this is the fantastic thing about theatre, and I had the thrill of thinking, oh, yeah, I'm a theatre composer again, where, you know, there's the needs of the production. We need a few more minutes here for something to happen on stage, or this doesn't work on stage, so we're going to cut it. We're going to do something else. And so I've actually written about 3 minutes of new music. So you're going to hear a kind of little mini premiere in this production.
Yeah. And is it written to accommodate the show? I mean, the direction, is it to sort of get somebody from A to B?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's
talk, if you don't mind, about some other aspects of music that you're involved in, because you are Professor Lim. And you have been involved in education for, quite a couple, 20 years, maybe more. You're a professor at Huddersfield University in the UK and now at Sydney Conservatorium or Sydney University. And I wonder whether you feel that has changed a lot, even in the time you've been there and certainly since you were a student. I mean, a lot of universities are getting rid of their music departments.
Yes, I have to say perhaps the Sydney Conservatorium of Music is going in the opposite direction. That is a music department that is thriving and...
It's hoovering up everything that's
growing,
left.
Growing, yeah. So that's an incredibly positive thing to say, that the power of music is absolutely recognised and needed in our community. But of course there are many challenges, you know, the world brings so many challenges in terms of questioning the position of the arts, the role of the arts, what training in the arts might be. So I think that is a challenge that every institution has to look at and respond to.
Tell me what the positive changes are in terms of that kind of training.
I would say there's been I'm just speaking locally, okay, just because that's my experience. One of the huge areas that has transformed is around inclusion. So we're seeing a huge transformation in terms of participation of women as leaders in composition. And, of course, at the University of Sydney, there was the Composing Women program that was initiated by Matthew Heinzen, and which I then took over. And that's had really positive results in terms of bringing forward leaders, women leadership in composition that is then also having an ongoing impact in terms of curriculum and just really opening up what it is, you know, what counts in music, whose voices are can be heard in music. So really quite basic questions, actually.
Is the program still continuing?
No, Composing Women itself is not continuing in that
Why?
Form because it really achieved a lot of what it set out to do, yeah.
So everything's okay?
No, I don't think everything's okay. I think it's a continuous. I think there's continuous vigilance around these questions. But you know, I think that aspect of representation, participation, but then at a much more fundamental level, you know, systemic change is what really makes the difference. And I think that's what we're really working on right now.
So if a young composer came to you now and said, you know, I want to be like you, how would you advise them? Would you say, as used to be the case, well, you must go overseas, or is there a better way of doing it?
Well, I think the basic question is I want you to be like yourself. And I think there are many ways of, of making that journey. Yeah. One of the things I want to comment on in relation specifically to this company and the people you'll see performing is that two of the singers, Jane Sheldon and Jessica O'Donoghue, Jane went through Composing Women and is making her own opera, and Jessica O'Donoghue is doing a PhD and also writing her opera. And so this is an example of kind of striking transformation that these extraordinary musicians with so much experience and, so much creativity in the past would never have had a chance to make their own opera, tell their own story.
It's interesting, yeah. Isn't it? That's something which is in a way coming back, which we had in the 19th century, where composers were performers and performers were expected to compose. And during the 20th century, it became quite a specialist thing, composing.
Yes, I'm just speaking mainly of gender, actually.
Yeah, so, but yeah. In general, it's happening. And it's not, I mean, it's remarkable that singers are writing operas, but percussionists are composers and brass players are composers suddenly. And that this is, I think, a good thing.
Of course, yeah, absolutely brilliant, because, that creativity and that, ways of just expressing, I mean, the whole diversification of the stories that are being told is something that is a really positive current stream in Australian music.
What about the stories themselves?
I think there's such a huge range, yeah, and that's what you have when you have more diversity, yeah, new kinds of stories, new kinds of, ways of telling, new forms of, new formats, new forms, new structures, yeah.
Speaking of new structures, maybe we could now talk about your music as it is now, in the context of what we're about to hear, this venerable piece, albeit with 3 new minutes. Your music has changed in the last 3 decades, as one would hope it would. And one of the things that I've noticed, particularly in pieces like the Piano Concerto and the Mary pieces and the Cello Concerto, Sutured World, is that there are many more moments of stability, perhaps, is the word, and that they are often connected with tonal centres the gravitational pull of what seems like a tonic note, for want of a better word. Can you talk a little about that and whether this is something you have done consciously? Obviously, you're aware of it, but is it something you set out to do, or does the music in a way compose you?
Well, there are a few things there. In terms of an interest in harmony, that really has come about through my work with orchestras. And I think when you have to kind of organise a lot of people and not have complete chaos on stage, that's where harmony becomes really, really useful. But I've always been interested in the beauty of sound and the beauty particularly of sort of an instrumental lyricism. And I've also been interested in what I would call kind of absurd and ridiculous moments. And so there was a piece recently in Melbourne, Elysian had its 40th anniversary, and it's a piece called Tailor of Time. And there's this moment where the percussionist is instructed to build up a tower called an impossible monument. So it's a tower of just kitchen sort of pots and pans and percussion instruments. And inevitably the tower collapses and interrupts the ensemble. So it's this idea of time being torn apart. It can't keep going and the musicians have to start again. And that is that's such a fantastically ridiculous notion. It's, of course, a percussionist dream. And so I find that there's kind of that is also another element of my music that seems to also be getting stronger.
Well, yeah. The playfulness.
Yes, absurdity, playfulness, and a kind of subversive kind of edge to that. But actually that also exists, and I hope you'll enjoy it in this opera.
I was going to, yeah. I was about yeah. to say that I recall there are playful elements in this. Yeah. So, big birthday this year, and I wonder whether when the 60-year-old Lisa Lim looks back at the 25-year-old who composed this piece, the Oresteia, do you recognise yourself?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, what a privilege to be able to hear a work come to life again with new generations of performers and a company like Sydney Chamber Opera. You know, it's both familiar and also, you know, far away. And so I've kind of enjoyed that kind of weird to and fro of time in revisiting this work.
And in revisiting it, do you learn things from that young composer? Is she capable of teaching you new ideas?
Absolutely. It's been great to be reminded of various ways of doing things, little expressive turns that I recognise. And then, you know, I've perhaps not investigated that or taken it further, and I'm like, oh, I could do that. But I guess the thing about time that I'm always really interested in is its non-linear nature, you know, so something that one kind of cast out or you know, set forth long ago, you can meet it again. And certainly this year when I have many performances, I do have this sense of many things in orbit, meeting those things and going, oh, that's nice to see you again. but also not holding on to it too much either.
No, they're like children. You've got to let them go. but some of them surprise you.
Yes, I'd like to be even more surprised, yeah. So that's what I have to do now. I have to do things that will really surprise me in, yeah, you know, but they, 10 or 20 years down the track.
But they yeah. also go yeah. away and yeah. if you don't see them for a long time, when they come back, they've changed, don't you find?
Yeah, because one has changed. I mean, that is the, you know, there's a reason why we revisit any work of art, right? Because we meet it, we co-create what it might be, yeah.
Lisa, thank you very much for sitting down and talking to me.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you.
the last movement of Lisa Lim's cello concerto, A Sutured World. The soloist Nicola Alstadt and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Edward Gardner. My thanks to Lisa Lim for sitting down with me for Music Now and Then, and our thanks also to the Carriage Works team and Sydney Chamber Opera for having us. The Oresteia runs at Carriage Works until the 31st of July, and the details are on the Music Show's website. The Music Show is produced by C. Benedict and Sky Kirkham, and technical production by Harvey O'Sullivan and Mickey Grossman, and the show is made on Gadigal, Gundungurra and Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. Next time on the show, two different Williams. One is the Broadway singer Will Swenson. He is taking on the role of Neil Diamond in a jukebox musical called A Beautiful Noise. And the other William is William Basinski, who returns to the show to revisit his disintegration loops.